Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It is Friday, February 19th, 2016. And this is Jeff Dunphy, and this is Retooling for Our Coming of Age. You can see our website is retooling.org, and our Facebook page is Retooling. Now, today, we're going to entertain the third episode of The Art and Science of Self-Discovery. Not sure how many episodes we are going to eventually have in this, but it will form part and parcel of how we create some aspect of tools and tooling for our discovery. We revisit the quote of "an unexamined life is not worth living" by Socrates. And I'd like to also remind everybody that wouldn't it be wonderful if those things that influenced us were all brought into the light so that we could better understand ourselves. As we better understand ourselves, we can then tend to the task of changing ourselves and changing ourselves to be more aligned with our soul's purpose, with our genius, with how we've propagated. There are things to be done by you that are done better by you than anybody else on the planet. How is it that we can change ourselves to better align ourselves with that? And just as discovering a food allergy can change our physical lives and our physical well-being, perhaps if we discover our thought allergies, we can lead more productive, progressive lives. Now, today we're going to chat a little about how our relationships can be brilliant contributors to our self-discovery. When you learn about yourself from the mirroring that goes on when you dance with another, it's very illuminating. Now, oftentimes the masters, these books and the sages that have written about, they write often about how a relationship can be enormously contributing to waking you up. And we have a meme, which is not incorrect, but there's also a corollary to that meme, and that is you have to love yourself before you can love another. And yet the flip side of that is possibly one of the better ways of learning how to love yourself is to love another. Interesting food for thought. Now, do we have the courage to be imperfect? Many people are very, very vested in being a certain way and also in being right. And part of the art of waking up and part of the art of figuring out who you are is being brutally honest and attentive to our mindfulness. We cannot practice compassion if we cannot treat ourselves kindly. And part of the art of being compassionate is treating others kindly. And are you willing to let go of who you think you should be in order to actually be who you are? And we're reminded of Brené Brown's work that I think is absolutely brilliant. And she's been doing some wonderful stuff. The book she wrote was Daring Greatly. And it talks about the art of being vulnerable. Not many people want to or can be vulnerable because certainly in men, it makes them feel weak. And in women, it makes them feel weak as well. And do you have the spiritual guts to change yourself and move into a state of higher self-awareness? Self-awareness creates an arena where I just said, wherein you can change yourself. And changing yourself to be more aligned with your soul's purpose is what we're all about here at Retooling for Your Coming of Age. Now, I want to chat a little about putting tools in the quiver, putting tools in your toolkit. We want to be able to deploy as many resources as possible. And it's usually the best approach. So I want to tell you a little about how the Mayo Clinic works, or rather how I understand the Mayo Clinic works. It's my understanding that you call and you make an appointment and you show up. You show up at the appointed time at 8 in the morning, and a doctor meets you, and that doctor stays with you the entire day, and he helps you navigate through the various specialists that you go see, the various investigative procedures, seeing all the experts and the like. And he wanders you through. He holds your hand. He navigates. He deciphers. He defines. He makes sure that all of your questions and all of the work that they're doing, you understand what is going on. And consequently, I suspect that it's a very tried and true method. So at the end of the day, at 5 o'clock, after you've been through all the tests, you are aware of what's going on, you are become more conversant with your physiology, you're more conversant with the tests that are going on. And having tools like that, having tools where you can navigate through the labyrinthian shtick of the mind, super important. And we're going to talk about some of those tools today. Becoming more aware of your thoughts is incredibly vital to your own self-discovery. Are there sabotaging and limiting subconscious programs that have been acquired from others, which all of us engage in about, get a load of this, 95% of the time? Absolutely. You absolutely bet there are, okay? So let's chat a little about just an example of a sabotaging thought or an event that happened in early childhood with somebody that then creates a subconscious program that continues to run in the background. And unless you're conscious, unless you're mindful, it sets the stage for certain things. So imagine, if you will, that your father was, he left, he abandoned the family. And so consequently, you may have, when you were young, subconsciously implanted a thought that says, the significant man in my life has just left, and so consequently, I will be abandoned by significant men in my life. What an interesting thought. Now, really, oftentimes this goes in unfettered and unfiltered, and it just sits there and it resides until you take the action to extricate that thought from running in the background. So now imagine, as a young woman, you start to date, and you start to affiliate yourself with the dating game, but all the time this program is running in your head. This individual, this man will abandon me because I'm not worthy of love and belonging. Back to Brené Brown's issue, I'm not worthy of having a positive, progressive, loving relationship. And so when that program is running in the background, there's a part of you that wants to make that program correct. And what an interesting aspect of having that program make you correct. Now, I want to chat a little about a brilliant individual named Bruce Lipton, who's written some books. He's written The Biology of Belief, and he's also written a book called The Honeymoon Effect, and it's really quite an interesting book. And what he talks about is the brain chemistry. He talks about conscious and subconscious. He talks about making the subconscious conscious, and he talks about what the studies have shown and how they may play into us being able to reprogram ourselves, if you will. He makes mention of four minds and how they interact with each other. He also makes mention of how reactivity happens oftentimes from being unconscious and allowing your subconscious programming to just sort of come to the surface. Now, the challenge with this is oftentimes your subconscious programming runs you 95% of the time, which is a very interesting thing, and I'll get into a little more of that there. But I want to chat a little about the honeymoon effect that he makes reference to, and it's two individuals who are madly in love with one another, and if in fact they have a soul contract, as some many do, they have a knowingness to their connection that then plays itself out in a very strong attractiveness, a sense of knowing that they've known each other in past lives or maybe many lives. And they, at the beginning of the relationship, they're both very conscious. They're both incredibly embracing of the other's needs and wants and desires. And really, there is a keenness to be incredibly contributory and helpful to the other's wants and needs and desires. And so each party, the man and the woman in the party, or whatever, whoever the parties are, each member of the party is very keen on contributing to the other's well-being and the like. So when we go on a year or maybe a couple of years, and all of a sudden what we start to bear witness to is when both aren't conscious and they default to their reactivity, we now have an event that happens when the husband turns to the wife and says something, and the wife is not conscious, and she reacts nastily. And so all of a sudden the husband goes, just a second, what did I do? What did I say? How did I present that? Da-da-da-da-da-da. And it creates a fracas. It creates resentment. It creates upset. It creates a tenor of tension. And this is sort of the end of the honeymoon effect. Now Bruce goes on in his book, The Honeymoon Effect. He goes on to talk about how you can resurrect it, mend it, change it, and become ever aware of not allowing your subconscious negative programming, because some of your subconscious programming is positive and is reflective of perhaps how you were raised or your family situation. And then the opposite happens. If you have a horrific childhood, that childhood casts many long, dark shadows as you're moving forward. Okay. So as time goes on, the default returns to your subconscious programming, and all of a sudden, you start to deal with four minds in the relationship. And these four minds are the consciously treating each other consciously and conscientiously. That's the wonderful part at the front end, when you're really keenly. And then you have the two unconscious minds, and that's how they're programmed, how they're raised, how their children, how their parents treated them, how their environment was in their social circumstance. Now, if in fact your sociology, your parenting, your upbringing was done in a way that was derogatory, nasty, mean, anxious, in some instances vicious, and if there was emotional abuse or even physical abuse, that can have quite a deleterious effect on you as you move into your adult life, because it's all subconscious. These programmings just, they run in the background. So to better understand how this happens, let's talk a little bit about the relationship between the brain and the mind. So the brain is kind of a device like a radio, right? The mind, both conscious and subconscious, is sort of like the programming that you hear on the radio. The activity of the conscious mind is primarily associated with the neural processing activity of the prefrontal cortex. That's the part that makes man, man. The last evolutionary addition to the human brain, okay? So the conscious mind is the seat of your personal identity. It identifies you as a distinct individual, a unique spirit, if you will. And the conscious mind manages your personal wishes, your desires, your aspirations. And so when I ask you what kind of relationships you want in your life, your lovely, high-minded answer comes from the conscious mind. I want a relationship based on love, equality, and respect, as well as sexual chemistry. This is the positive thinking mind that optimistically sticks post-it notes on the refrigerator that says, I deserve a loving relationship, or I eat healthy food, such and such, right? This is also the part of the mind that can look to the past and the future. It's not bound by time. Your conscious mind can answer questions about what you're doing next week and what you did last week. It's the mind that can detach from the current moment and sort of daydream about what might happen, about your desires to find your Prince Charming or your desires to win the lottery or whatever. Now, but hold on for a second. If your conscious mind isn't paying attention and managing your present moment, because it's busy thinking great thoughts or winning a lottery or what kind of life you want to live, who is left managing that show? Interesting, isn't it? So the neuroscience tells us that because of the conscious mind's ability to flip from thought to thought, and the environment that we're in, which is so full of distraction, we use, on average, personally creative conscious mind to control our behavior or regulating our cognitive activity about 5% of the time. Isn't that stunning? So by default, the remaining 95% of our cognitive activity is controlled by previously acquired programs downloaded into the subconscious mind. So whatever radio program we were listening to, whatever parenting we got, that is our default, which is illuminating. You can use that to your benefit. We aren't here to moan and groan about the fact that our parents weren't particularly good or conscious and that our environment was tough and harsh and that the pre-programming that we got is incredibly detrimental to our living a healthy, productive, conscious life. But 5% of the time, we're in that creative consciousness, and 95% of the time is running the show. Our subconscious mind is running the show. So the subconscious mind is the mind that, never mind the post-it notes, compels us to, you know, to dive into the fridge and eat the pie, or compels us to do something silly that we know consciously is not particularly contributory to us, okay? The subconscious is associated with the neural activity of a much larger part of the brain, 90% of the brain, than the conscious mind's prefrontal cortex. So we have the limbic brain, the reptilian brain, and the limbic brain. So we've got various parts of our brain. The subconscious mind is also a profoundly more powerful influence on our behavior than the conscious mind. So the conscious mind's prefrontal cortex, get a load of this, can manage and process about 40 nerve impulses a second. Now, in contrast, the 90% of the brain that constitutes the subconscious mind's platform can process 40 million nerve impulses per second. That makes the subconscious mind's processor a million times more powerful than the conscious mind. You might at this point be developing a decidedly negative attitude toward your powerful subconscious mind that is sabotaging your best efforts to create awareness or even a honeymoon effect, right, in your life. And it does give us food for thought. But the subconscious mind plays a most important and valuable role in human development. In any case, it's a waste of time to fight or blame the subconscious mind and start to play the old patterns. You stupid idiot, why did you eat the pie? Or you stupid idiot, you're going to get fat, or whatever, right? You can yell all you want and blame all you want, but you're wasting your time because there's nobody in the subconscious mind that will respond to that rant. Demonizing your subconscious mind or demonizing your parents who have violated you because of their ignorance or their lack of skill is a waste of time. And to demonize them is akin to screaming at your television, watching a show that is mindless or derogatory or detracts from your development is silliness, okay? What are you watching? Don't blame the TV set. Blame the programming. Is your subconscious mind good or bad? No, it's neither, okay? The subconscious mind is primarily an amazing record playback mechanism that, unlike the conscious mind, expresses little creativity and also has no sense of time. It's always in the present moment. It doesn't see a future and certainly doesn't listen or care when you yell at it. So rather than demonizing or battling with your subconscious over its bothersome behavioral programming, or beating up and trashing your parents because of their ignorance and their shortcomings as parents, because really one of the greatest gifts we can do is forgive our parents for their trespasses and their shortcomings, it's best to acknowledge its power. Okay, it's best to acknowledge its power. And let's sort of investigate how we can use our awareness of it to potentially reprogram it, to absolutely reprogram it. And also recognize how your best intentions and your best wishes towards wonderful relationships have been sabotaged by your subconscious mind. And now what we're going to do, we're not doomed to live with our subconscious mind's self-sabotaging behaviors. And what I will do is I'll post to our site, Retooling, I will post a variety of tools that will and can eliminate this negative programming, okay? So we want to reprogram our subconscious mind so we can remove the invisible obstacles that are preventing you from creating a wonderful relationship and a wonderful rapport with your partners. Now let's also chat a little about how programming happens when you're in utero. You have an environment in utero where the mother and father are fighting or drinking or being mindless in their living. Their life is living them. They're upset with each other. That is passed right along to the child in utero, believe it or not, okay? So we have genetic control. We've got genes involved. We've got the maternal's blood swimming in the child. However, what also happens is there's chemistry involved when the mother is living her life while the child is in utero. Okay, so now if the child is unwanted, then the fetus and the baby gets bathed in chemistry that creates a negative chemistry. If the child is wanted, but the parents are constantly bickering and fighting and upset, the child picks that up. Now, we are all connected, and how could we not all be connected? And then it plays itself into the thought, the esoteric reality, that we picked our parents for a very important reason. And the further we get along in our evolutionary process, the more conscious our soul is conscious, but the more defined our picking our parents is. So we actually pick our parents for a reason. And when we pick our parents for a reason, we park ourselves in an environment that is conducive to our working out our karma. And so when we play that hand of working out our karma, we can see with brilliant clarity this magic space of going, I picked my parents to learn a lesson. And when we wander through that again, we start to say, well, okay, what is it? What is the lesson I am to pick? And that's when the Charlene and Jeff conversation that we had last week plays itself in. Well, let's investigate our astrology. Let's investigate our predilections. Let's investigate our parenting and how it has affected us. And let's figure out how our subconscious programming oftentimes gets in the way of living a productive, conscious life where our soul integration presents itself so that we can change the world. We can contribute to the evolutionary process of changing the world. When we make those things, when we turn the lights on those things, they can no longer affect us negatively. Now, have we played a part where we are very reactive to things? Absolutely. Have you found yourself going, whoa, that was a very interesting and reactive thing? We talked about at the beginning of the show how we have to be brutally honest with ourselves in order to change ourselves, you know, and how we best dance with various partners. And I want to talk about another individual who's done some big work in relationships. And his name is Tai Tashiro. Now, he is not particularly esoterically organized, but he certainly is a very accomplished psychologist, and they've done some brilliant work. And I want to chat a little about how is it that we best dance with an ideal partner. Now, when you are aware of your soul call and you are aware of soul contracts with individuals that you get into relationships with, oftentimes they are frustrated by either or both parties' subconscious programming. And when either party is unwilling to turn the lights on to that unconscious programming, those relationships are destined to fail or destined to be unhappy and full of conflict. So now I want to chat a little about, you know, we talk to our kids about who they want to be when they grow up, what they want to be when they grow up, or who they want to be when they grow up. But we also talk about what's the ideal partner, right? Or the ideal aspect of being in high school. So let's say there's a girl in high school and she is quite keen on losing her virginity before her senior year, or she loses it at prom and she goes and picks the candidate, and she puts a checklist on the door for the ideal candidate to lose her virginity for. Now, her programming or her predilection is, I need to lose my virginity before the end of high school. And consequently, who should I pick to lose my virginity to? And so the girl sits down and says, well, he needs to be tall, he needs to be handsome, he needs to be an athlete. And so she makes a checklist, and all of a sudden the only ideal guy for her to lose her virginity to is the quarterback of the football team. So she lays the groundwork, she flirts with him, she, you know, sort of shows a little shoulder, she sort of whistles and goes, yoo-hoo, over here, and there's a very interesting approach to her ideal. So what goes on is they go into the back room, they organize itself, and consequently she's accommodating her desire to lose her virginity. The quarterback shows up, they have sex, and it so happens that it's unprotected, and all of a sudden she becomes into that place of, oh my God, what if I'm pregnant? Now, many, and rightfully so or wrongfully so, depending on where you sit, many think that if you get pregnant that you should have that child, and that raising that child is a very important and vibrant and vital thing. So perhaps going through her head is, oh my God, I'm going to have to live with this guy now, and I'm going to have to marry him. And then she starts to look at what is really important in a relationship, right? So the research that speaks very loudly to some very definitive conclusions. And even though does he make enough money? Does he have a good job? All the words on the checklist is quite interesting. Now, Ty, in one of his videos, he sets, you know, he's in a room of 300 or 400 or 500 people. And he says, okay, so the checklist is he has to be tall. So he gets everybody to stand up, and he says, everybody who's less than 6 foot, sit down. So most of the crowd sits down. Okay, everybody who earns more than $250,000, sit down. Okay, and so what he shows us is that on our checklist, almost quite shockingly, if you have a checklist of makes a bunch of money, is really tall, is really handsome, or various things, you eliminate almost everybody to dance with in your dance to find the right partner, the right mate, which is a very interesting avenue, right? So in the pursuit of trying to find the right mate, you eliminate all kinds of potentials. And in his book, he talks about, one, he talks about the red flags, about finding the people to drop tools and run away from. But he also identifies the very important things that you need to put at the top of your checklist in order to facilitate a happy relationship. Now, the human kingdom is incredibly plugged into relationship. And when you become intimately engaged in a relationship, it's an unbelievable tool for your own spiritual development. So when you find somebody who is on the spiritual path and aware of the spiritual path and their soul integration, you can, with diligence and spiritual guts, as Douglas Baker made reference to, you can pursue an awakened way, but it's not pretty, gets ugly pretty quickly, and it's not easy. It's a real challenge. Now, let's chat a little about the flags. Let's chat a little about the flags that are ever mindful of individuals you may not want to dance with, because these are warning signs, okay? Now, one of the bigger warning signs that Ty's research and other people's research has spoken to is neuroticism, okay? And it talks about neuroticism being one of the more important personality predictors of future relationship satisfaction and stability, okay? So individuals, whether they're male or female, if they're neurotic, they're actually more likely to break up with partners who are low in neuroticism compared to partners who are high. It's as if the neurotics could not stand their good fortune. You know, and across numerous studies, neurotic partners are at the higher risk of relationship instability and divorce, okay? The other aspect is impulse control. One of the things that happens in relationships that creates trouble or challenges is that individuals are less competent in controlling their impulses. So they just do things willy-nilly. They just hop into bed with somebody, or they just they act without giving due attention to the possibility of the consequences of the action, right? So partners low in impulse control and also high in novelty seeking are a combination of high openness and low conscientiousness. So to get a two-for-one deal on your wishes, let's just combine low to moderate conscientiousness and high levels of openness into a trait that personality psychologists call novelty seeking. The good news about partners high in novelty seeking is that they usually don't have the self-control to hide their personality for that long. However, the confusing part about novelty seekers is that early on in a relationship, they are fun and spontaneous and exciting. They also become easily and deeply absorbed in a relationship when they are first falling for you. And it feels great to have someone so invested and intrigued. However, the other side of that is this. Novelty seeking is also associated with an increased risk for substance abuse and abusive behavior and explosiveness during discussions about conflict, which are all associated with less relationship satisfaction. Now, some of the studies talk about where they'll plug the male and they'll plug the two partners into physiological feedback systems, and they will show with about 95% certainty that the couples that are best suited to a long-lasting relationship are those couples that feel very comfortable and calm around one another. So their physiology is, they're calm, everything's copacetic. They're not frantic, and they aren't feeling attacked. Now, the couples that are the least competent in that regard, the ones that are constantly in fight or flight, they're constantly bickering or quibbling or have being passive aggressive in their thing. I mean, the couples that are not particularly responsive to one another. There was a great quote in one of these books that I've read about, the woman and the man go to the Philharmonic constantly. And when, you know, somebody was chatting with the man away from his wife, and he said, "Do you really like the Philharmonic?" He said, "Oh yeah, we've been going to it for 35 years. But then the man says, "I don't really like it that much, but my wife likes it so much that I'm happy to go because I love my wife so much." That kind of responsiveness is a really good indicator of relationship success. And it's a wonderful thing in that, right? Now, back to the novelty seeking issue that we were talking about. Novelty seeking is also incredibly predictive of becoming bored easily with doing the same thing, which is a recipe for disaster when it comes to sustaining a relationship with one person every day. Novelty seekers' tendencies combine to make partners who provide less relationship stability, obviously. They're more likely to end the relationship because the spark is gone. Essentially, they burn bright at the start, showing tremendous interest in you and the relationship, but are more likely to burn out in a rapid and spectacular fashion. So everything's great at the front end, but in all fairness, it burns out and they go on to what they assume is greener territories on the other, on the other side of the fence. Now, this pattern, if you are unconscious to it, just keeps happening. You're constantly looking for some novelty in a new dance partner, and it never sates itself because that's part of your unconscious programming. Now, there was an experiment done with young children at about 16 or 18 months old. Now, in this experiment, they brought in, let's say, 1,000 mothers and young children. And the mothers and young children were brought in, and And the child was put on the mother's lap, and they sat down, and there was various toys in the room. And what the experiment was, what would happen to the child when the child discovers that the mother's not there anymore? And so the mother was instructed, sit with the child on your lap for a bit until the child gets, the curiosity gets the child, and then put the child down, and the child will start to play, and then the mother slips out of the room. And what they found in this experiment was that there are three kinds of children. And these are, again, quite young children that are. So the first child looks around and sees that it has lost, its mother's disappeared, and every one of them freaks out and goes, oh my goodness, and they start to cry. And at that point, the second the child realizes that the mother's gone, the mother comes back in, sits back down, comforts the child, and makes things right with the child. And the child, the first group of children, are that group of children where go, oh, good, okay, you're back, you're here, we're all good, things are copacetic, and now I can get back to investigating here. So I'm safe, my mother's close, we're all good. Now that was one group of reactions. So the next group, the next reaction, when the child discovers that the mother's not there, turns around and goes, oh my goodness, and starts to cry, the mother comes back in and sits with the child and calms the child down. But the second group reacts in this way, that the child gets off the mother's lap, and instead of integrating, you know, looking back every now and again and checking in with the mother as the first group did, the mother's there and everything's okay. This one got off the mother's lap and basically never looked back. It's as if they energetically said, you're going to abandon me anyway, so I'm not going to give you much attention because soon enough you're going to leave me. Which again is one of those subconscious programming aspects that these children pick up very young in their lives. And those work desperately against you achieving any level of satisfaction in a relationship. Now, when you bring that to light and when you bring that to mind, you can go, ah, perhaps that needs to be investigated, and perhaps that thought of I am going to be abandoned can be changed by reprogramming. Okay? Now, one of the things when we are comfortable and we are agreeable and we are, this is the ideal of having good guys finish last in a relationship or agreeableness. Gets a bad rap in the dating world, but it's one of the most and best predictors of long-term relationship happiness. Let me say that again. Agreeableness is one of the best predictors of long-term relationship happiness. Someone who is genuinely agreeable is more empathetic and is more capable of intimacy. Men high in agreeableness are not only more likely to be kind, but are also more likely to keep the sexual desire alive in a relationship. And one of the things that happens when we as a couple become more and more intimate, now intimate not necessarily just in the physical, but in the emotional and in the intellectual and in the mental, when you become more and more intimate, those individuals who are prone to feel like you're being abandoned, the subconscious programming that's going on through in their head is, oh my goodness, as soon as he figures out who I am, he's going to leave me. Just like my dad did when I was 8 or 6 or 5 or 10 or 12. As soon as he figures out who I am, he's going to leave me. And this subconscious programming is running in the background, and it's compromising your capacity to participate in a worthwhile relationship. Okay? So what they found in these studies was one of the best variables for predicting who would stay married, even better than love. People can be very much in love and not dance very well in a marriage. Expressions of affection. And the expressions of affection are responsiveness, right? The guy saying, I went to the Philharmonic for 40 years because my wife really liked it. And some of the studies were when individuals were seeking a response from their partner, from their spouse. They were reaching out to get a response. And the successful relationships are those where that responsiveness comes back in kind and kindly comes back in kind. So when the woman says, look at that lovely bird over there, the man can respond in three ways. He can respond, or four ways, I guess, but he can respond by, yes, isn't that wonderful and lovely, even though he doesn't really care about birds, but he can be responsive to her bid for a response. Or he can say, I'm busy, and ignore it. Or he can just basically say, I don't care. Both of those actions, I don't care or leave me alone, I'm busy, are barometers of a relationship that is unhappy or doomed to fail. Okay? So one of the best predictors for those who would stay married and continue on in a healthy relationship was responsiveness. And that responsiveness is also closely related to the personality trait of agreeableness. So the old adage, nice guys finish last, is not the case at all. Okay? So couples who remained married were more responsive than those who divorced. However, here's an interesting note here. The only variable that distinguished happily married couples from those who were unhappily married and from the two groups that divorced was contrariness, which is the variable most closely related to the personality trait of neuroticism. Now, one of the things that we find and see in neuroticism, and one of the things that we find and see in learning how to dance with people effectively, is how contrariness is learned, possibly, at an early stage in one's development. So let's say a child is in an environment where it's emotionally abusive, there's lots of yelling and screaming and nasty stuff going on. And imagine, if you will, that child learns to be incredibly discriminating and discerning, but also learns to be incredibly critical as they're growing up, because being critical when they're growing up gives them some sense of control. And as you develop that critical aspect of yourself, you figure that if you can find fault with absolutely everybody, you can create a barrier, you can arm yourself against them finding fault with you. So what an interesting approach now, right? So as you develop this critical nature where you scan the environment to find fault with whatever is there. Now, not only will this not ever serve you well, it will also prevent you from ever dancing in a relationship that is conducive to kindness, agreeableness, responsiveness, because what you're doing is scanning the environment for faults rather than scanning the environment for attributes or positive things. So a healthy relationship is one where an individual looks at another and speaks kindly of their actions, speaks appreciatively of their grace, and notices their wonderful attributes. This is a relationship where we dance in a way that gives the partner a lovely, wonderful reputation to live up to, rather than through being critical, being hypercritical, and constantly scanning the environment for faults and condemning and criticizing and complaining. You now create an energy and an environment with your partner where you're giving them a reputation to live down. And so in that result, when you have that environment that is created by a dance in that regard, you create an environment which promotes illness. It promotes self-deprecating thoughts. It promotes discord. And consequently, one of those things that needs to happen is you need to recognize and come to that place where you say, I need to change that subconscious programming. And so when our first reaction is to criticize and condemn or complain, And that has been put in place because as a young child, that was what you used as a tool to protect yourself. Then when you become made aware of that, you then participate in a revelatory moment so that you can change the very fabric of your life. Now, the changing of the fabric of your life comes back to, are we prepared and do we have the courage to recognize our imperfections? Do we have the spiritual guts to be brutally honest and attentive to our mindfulness? And do we have that all-encompassing embrace and intention to change ourselves? Now, one of the things that this begs is, where do you want to go with this? And one of the things that begs this question is, if you know you are broken, or if you know that you have broken aspects of your subconscious programming and you don't do anything about it, there's something wrong with that. Which I think Ayn Rand pointed this out. She said, the law of free will lets you choose to ignore certain things. But the consequences of ignoring certain things, you can't change the effects of that, right? That if you can stick your head in the sand, but you cannot hide from the effects of sticking your head in the sand. So again, part of this whole thing, right? Do we have the stick-to-itiveness, and do we have the intention to wake up to what we do? And can we sit quietly and recognize that there are subconscious programming thoughts in our mind that are detracting from our well-being, they're detracting from our happiness, they're detracting from our ability to consciously and conscientiously interact with individuals? So isn't it an interesting thought that you might meet your soulmate that you are to spend a lifetime changing the world in, and your subconscious programming is such that it drives the two of you apart because you don't have the chutzpah to address it collaboratively and intimately so that you can step into a new state of reality and a new state of awareness? Some interesting thoughts, right? Some interesting thoughts. So part of this examination, part of the art and science of self-discovery, is being able to see yourself for who you really are, not for who you pretend to be, not for who you would like to think you are or you think you should be. And so therein lies the challenge. It is a very interesting challenge. It's an interesting challenge merely because it takes an enormous amount of courage to be able to stand in that place, to be able to stand in that place and be honest and to be sincere and to be interested in changing yourself. Because as we learn about ourselves, we get the opportunity to change ourselves. And if you can change yourselves, you also, in full consciousness and mindfulness, can change other people as well. Okay? So that being said, we participate in this avenue of self-discovery. And we participate in this avenue of self-discovery in a way that turns the lights on so brightly that we start to see through the nonsense. We start to see through the programming, the derogatory programming. We start to see through the crap that keeps us from being a fully integrated soul in our personality. We participate in activity that lets us integrate and synthesize our soul into our personality, so our personality no longer gets in the way. Let's noodle on that. Is your personality serving you, Or is your personality hijacking you as a result of your subconscious programming? Let us be ever mindful of how that plays itself out in your reactivity, in the way that you dance with people, and potentially in the way that you may have found a soul partner, somebody you've had a soul contract with, and you may have sabotaged it. We all have bouts of self-sabotage. When we become aware of them, we can make amends. We can step back into a conscious dance, and we can participate in a loving, kind, responsive relationship. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Jeff Dunphy. It is Friday, February 19th, 2016. This is Retooling for Our Coming of Age, and this is the third episode in the Art and Science of Self-Discovery. I want to thank you very much for listening to this little episode, and I trust that it is contributory to your self-awareness, it's contributory to your relationships, and I look forward to speaking with you again. Thank you for allowing me to be of service. I greatly appreciate your attention and your grace. See you next week.